Imagine a ruthless modern day drug cartel, but imagine that cartel isn't run by outlaws hiding out in the jungle. It's actually run by the government of a global superpower.
Right, which already sounds pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, exactly. And to enforce their smuggling routes, they don't just use, bribes or street gangs. They actually deploy the world's most advanced industrialized navy.
I mean, it literally sounds like the plot of a dystopian thriller.
It really does. But it's actually a very accurate description of how the global economy was engineered.
Yeah, it's history.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Usually when you picture the British Empire, the image that comes to mind is very territorial. And frankly, it's kind of
Oh,
sanitized.
definitely. You picture like a world map with half the globe painted pink.
Right, or royal crests, red coats, maybe, a very polite cup of tea. It's a comforting image because it's just so easy to categorize in a history book, but today's stack of sources completely dissolves that map.
It really does. Because we're looking at 18th century letters from Chinese officials, economic analyses of modern offshore tax havens, and even a highly controversial modern political dossier.
Yeah, and when you synthesize all of this material, that traditional image of kings and land grabs just, well, it vanishes entirely.
What emerges instead is, honestly, the architecture of a machine.
Exactly. So today's mission is to examine the British Empire not as a traditional kingdom, but as a relentless, evolving financial machine. We are going to explore the specific methods Britain used to treat and involve itself with other nations, specifically China and the United States.
Right, and we'll look at how those countries fought back.
Yes, and how those historical collisions ultimately produce the invisible financial web that you and I live inside today. Okay, let's unpack this. To understand the modern, sophisticated financial web, we first have to look at how Britain operated when it relied on brute force, like forced markets. So let's go back to the 18th century.
We have to start with one of the most shocking trade imbalances in human history.
Right.
In the 18th and early 19th centuries, Britain had a massive problem with China. British consumers were, well, they were absolutely addicted to Chinese goods. They couldn't get enough tea, silk, and porcelain.
Yeah, the demand was huge.
But the Chinese wanted absolutely nothing from Britain in return.
Which makes sense because China was largely self-sufficient at the time. They didn't need British goods. But how did the Chinese actually enforce that on a superpower?
Through something called the Canton system. So the Qing dynasty heavily restricted foreign trade. Westerners weren't allowed to just roam the country selling goods.
Right, they couldn't just set up shop anywhere.
Exactly. They were confined to a small trading area in Canton, which is modern-day Guangzhou, and they could only trade with a very specific guild of Chinese merchants.
Wow.
The rules were strict. And most importantly, the Chinese demanded payment in one thing only, which was silver.
Just silver.
Just silver. So Britain was literally hemorrhaging its silver reserves just to pay for all this tea.
And the British East India Company, which we should remember wasn't just a regular business, right? It was essentially a corporate arm of the British state, complete with its own army.
Yeah, a massive army.
Right. So they realize this silver drain is completely unsustainable. They need a product that the Chinese will actually buy. And their method to fix this deficit is, well, it's state-sponsored drug trafficking.
It is staggering when you look at the mechanics of it. The East India Company decides to completely monopolize the production of opium in India, specifically in regions like Patna.
Okay.
So they grow it, they process it, and then they orchestrate an illegal smuggling network to just flood the Chinese market with this highly addictive narcotic.
And it worked, right, financially speaking.
The financial results are instantaneous. By the 1820s, the trade balance entirely flips. Instead of Britain draining its silver for tea, China's now draining its own silver reserves just to pay for the smuggled opium.
Man, that's dark. Which brings us to the Chinese response, because they didn't just sit back and let this happen. By 1839, the social and financial devastation in China is so severe that the emperor appoints a man named Lin Zexu as special commissioner to stop it.
Right.
And he takes these drastic, fascinating actions. He actually writes an impassioned letter directly to Queen Victoria.
He does, and it's a brilliant document, really.
Yeah.
He pleads with her on moral grounds. He's essentially saying, you don't allow this poison in your own country, so how can you possibly justify sending it to ours?
Right, pointing out the absolute hypocrisy.
Exactly. But when diplomacy fails, Lin Zexu takes physical action. He seizes millions of pounds of illicit opium from the foreign merchants in Canton.
And he destroys it, right?
Publicly, he destroys it by dissolving it in trenches with lime and salt. Just completely ruins it.
And from the sources, it seems like that was the exact excuse the British were waiting for. The method changes from covert smuggling to overt military force. This kicks off the first Opium War. But I want to be clear for the listener here. This wasn't two equal armies meeting on a battlefield.
Oh, not at all. The British had heavily industrialized by this point. They brought in these advanced steam-powered warships, most famously the Nemesis.
The Nemesis! What a name!
Well, these ships were clad in iron, they could navigate shallow rivers against the wind, and they used long-range artillery to simply obliterate the Chinese coastal defenses.
Wow.
Yeah, and the Chinese war junks were still relying on really antiquated technology. It was a bloodbath.
And the justification for this slaughter is wild. They didn't tell the public they were fighting to protect a drug cartel. They framed it under this noble-sounding guise of enforcing free trade.
What's fascinating here is the sheer audacity of the legal outcome. China is beaten into submission and forced to sign the 1842 Treaty of Nanjing.
The first of the unequal treaties.
Exactly. Britain extorts a massive $3 million indemnity to cover the destroyed opium. They seize the island of Hong Kong as a permanent base, and they claim something called extraterritoriality.
Wait, extraterritoriality? Explain how that actually worked in practice.
So it meant that any British citizen living in China was immune to Chinese law.
Wait, really?
Yeah. If a British sailor committed a crime in Canton, the local Chinese police could not try him. He could only be judged by a British consul under British law. It fundamentally stripped China of its sovereignty within its own borders.
So to go back to our opening analogy, it really is a state-sponsored cartel, but one that can literally rewrite your country's laws after it shoots its way into your ports.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
And the tragedy only deepened from there. When China tried to resist further demands during the Second Opium War, British and French troops actually marched on Beijing and deliberately burned down the Yuan Mingyuan, the emperor's stunning summer palace.
It was just an act of calculated psychological destruction.
Yes.
This whole era ushered in what is known in China as the century of humiliation.
Yeah.
The destruction of the summer palace was so profound that the famous French novelist Victor Hugo actually wrote a scathing letter about it.
Oh, I read that in the source deck, yeah.
He called Britain and France two bandits who entered a wonder of the world just to plunder and burn it. He highlighted the dark irony that the Europeans consider themselves the civilized ones while treating the Chinese as barbarians.
That's a powerful quote. So we've seen how the British Empire operated when forcing a product into a closed foreign market at gunpoint. But what happens when the dynamic shifts? Like, how does the empire extract wealth out of a market that it actually built, a market made up of its own citizens?
That requires a totally different set of mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us to the American colonies.
Right.
Following a series of massive global wars, the British Parliament was drowning in debt. They viewed the American colonies not as an equal part of the kingdom, but as a captive economic engine.
So mercantilism.
Yes, exactly. Their method was mercantilism. They imposed oppressive direct taxation on the colonists to pay down British debts, while strictly limiting who the colonies could even trade with.
So you can only buy from us and you can only sell to us.
Right. The colonies were expected to be a farm supplying raw materials to Britain and a captive audience forced to buy really expensive British manufactured goods.
Which brings us to the American response, and specifically Alexander Hamilton. Looking at the sources, Hamilton writes this incredibly sharp argument for economic rebellion.
He was brilliant at this.
Yeah, he basically says that the British House of Commons has no more right to dispose of American property than the Great Mogul. He recognizes the colonies are just being used as an extraction point. But his proposed solution wasn't just, like, a protest. It was a targeted economic weapon.
Exactly. Hamilton became a massive advocate for a strict non-importation and non-exportation agreement.
An embargo.
Right, an embargo. And he understood the mechanics of the British economy intimately. He argued that Great Britain was entirely dependent on this dual-sided colonial trade.
Yeah.
If America simply stopped sending its raw materials and stopped buying British goods, it would just choke the British economy. Hamilton argued this embargo would introduce beggary and wretchedness to the English working class and essentially force Parliament to back down.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Think about the incredible irony here. For two centuries, Britain poured resources into building up the population and the wealth of the American colonies, right, to serve the empire.
Right.
But that very success created a consumer market so massive that threatening to close it gave America the exact economic leverage it needed to fight back.
It's a classic case of imperial miscalculation. But when the Americans tried to use this economic leverage through their petitions and embargoes, the British responded with a disastrous misread of the situation.
Yeah, they doubled down.
Instead of negotiating, they responded with total contempt. They suspended local governments, and they sent the Royal Navy to blockade American ports. They relied entirely on the fear of their subjects, completely abandoning their affection.
And that blunt force response inevitably pushed the colonies right into the Revolutionary War.
Which America wins.
And that victory creates a massive problem for the British financial machine. Direct taxation is officially off the table. I mean, they can't just send tax collectors to Boston anymore.
No, definitely not.
So how does an empire adapt when it loses physical control of its most valuable asset? I want to pause here because this is where our sources take a fascinating and, well, highly controversial turn.
Yeah, we're shifting gears here.
Right. According to a modern political dossier we're looking at called Promethean Action, the empire didn't just walk away. They shifted their methods to covert, cultural, and proxy warfare.
And to be super clear here, we are neutrally exploring the theory presented in this dossier. We're just trying to understand a very different perspective on British strategy.
Exactly. We're not endorsing the claims. We're just reading what's on the page.
Right. So according to this text, the core identity of the British Empire was never about human advancement. It was always about maintaining a monopoly on global finance. And the dossier claims that when they lost physical control of America, the powerful British Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, developed a new method called cultural warfare.
How does cultural warfare actually work in this context? I mean, what does that look like?
Well, the theory is that Palmerston protected and sponsored subversive revolutionary figures in London. People like the Italian Giuseppe Mazzini, who went on to spawn radical groups all across Europe.
Okay.
In the United States, this influence supposedly spread through an American disciple named Edwin de Leon. In the 1840s, de Leon founded a movement called Young America.
And what was their goal?
The dossier claims this group was deeply hostile to the federal government and actively agitated for Southern secession.
Okay, wait. Let me push back on the logic of this for a second. If Britain just lost a massively costly war to America a few decades prior, and they still heavily rely on American cotton, why would they risk arming a rebellion and destabilizing the whole region instead of just staying out of it?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the dossier argues the method was pure divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer.
Right. A unified, rapidly industrializing America was an existential threat to Britain's global trade monopoly. They saw the writing on the wall.
Okay, that makes sense.
However, a fractured, divided America, specifically an agrarian South that relied on British manufacturing, fighting a war against the industrial North, was highly profitable and just far easier to manipulate.
And according to the historical records in our stack, this involvement wasn't just theoretical philosophy discussed in London parlors. It was cold, hard logistics during the American Civil War. The British actively supplied the Confederacy.
They really did.
Like, at the Battle of Gettysburg, Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia was equipped almost entirely with British rifles. These were manufactured by the Birmingham small arms trade, which had deep ties to the British government.
It was an enormous logistical undertaking, and it wasn't just weapons either. By the late stages of the war, around 1864, the Confederate Army was surviving almost entirely on British provisions.
Wait, really? Like food?
Food, yeah. We are talking about literal tons of British bacon and supplies being systematically smuggled by British blockade runners into ports like Wilmington, North Carolina, just to keep the rebellion alive.
That is wild. But the outcome of this covert proxy war was a failure for Britain, right? The plot to dismember the United States failed.
Completely failed.
Instead, the crucible of the Civil War forced the U.S. to explode into an industrial superpower. They adopted what was called American system economic methods. What exactly did that entail?
The American system was essentially a direct rejection of the British free trade model. It focused on heavy protectionist tariffs to nurture domestic factories, the creation of a national bank to control their own credit, and massive federal investments in infrastructure.
Like the Transcontinental Railroad.
Exactly. They built an internal economy that simply didn't need the British Empire.
Which forces the final and frankly most mind-bending evolution of our deep dive today. The physical British Empire, the one that could sail the Nemesis into China or smuggle bacon past a Union blockade, eventually collapses after the devastation of the two world wars.
Yeah, the physical empire fades.
But the sources reveal that the financial machine didn't die. It simply hid in plain sight. It transitioned from gunboats to tax havens.
And this is where the history connects directly to the modern global economy. Our economic sources point out a jaw-dropping statistic. The British Empire remains a decisive, dominant force in the contemporary financial system.
Still today.
Through its former colonies and dependencies, places like the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, the British Virgin Islands, Jersey, the Isle of Man, and Hong Kong, this supposedly defunct empire accounts for a massive 37% share of all international banking liabilities today.
So what does this all mean? How does a dead empire control over a third of global cross-border wealth?
The method this time wasn't military force or proxy wars. It was the weaponization of legal fiction, specifically English common law.
Okay, explain that.
Well, in the 19th century, British courts developed a habit of interpreting tax laws based strictly on the literal words of the law, entirely ignoring the actual intent of the lawmakers.
So finding loopholes.
Exactly. The 1869 Partington case set the precedent. If a wealthy individual or a corporation can find a grammatical loophole in the exact wording, they are legally free from the tax, regardless of the spirit of the law.
It's like a corporate shell game. And the ultimate magic trick was the 1929 Egyptian Delta case. Explain the mechanics of that loophole, because it is just brilliant.
That case created the foundation for modern tax evasion. The British court decided to separate a company's legal registration from its mind and management.
Mind and management.
Right. It established that a company could be legally registered in the United Kingdom, basically just having a brass plaque in a mailbox in London.
Just a plaque.
But if its actual business operations and its board of directors were located abroad, it could shield itself entirely from UK taxes.
So suddenly, any tiny British colonial island with a post office could serve as an impenetrable shield against taxation.
Exactly.
And then, in the 1950s and 60s, the Bank of England turbocharged this system. They allowed the creation of something called the Euro Market right inside the city of London.
This is a crucial mechanism. The Euro Market was an offshore market operating onshore. It allowed U.S. banks, and eventually global banks, to legally evade the financial regulations and reserve requirements of their own home countries.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If a U.S. bank wanted to do a massive, risky dollar transaction without the U.S. government interfering, they simply booked the transaction through their branch in London. The Bank of England agreed to look the other way, meaning London became an unregulated playground for global capital.
This is the ultimate evolution. After World War II, Britain simply couldn't afford to subsidize its remaining colonial outposts. So the British government effectively told these islands to go become offshore tax havens to support themselves.
They did.
They merged the financial power of the City of London with this network of island dependencies to create a unified global shadow economy. You don't need a steam-powered warship to control a country if you control the banking regulations that hold their wealth.
And to bring this full circle back to the claims in the Promethean Action dossier, the authors argue that this modern network of central bankers and offshore money laundries still actively targets sovereign nations today.
Right.
The dossier cites a 2018 House of Lords report that explicitly outlines strategies to contain the Trump administration's unilateral foreign policies.
Right.
The report stated that defending the British rules-based international order was paramount. According to this perspective, the empire views any nation that acts independently, prioritizing its own industrial growth over global financial integration, as a threat to this massive interconnected web.
And the goal remains exactly the same as it was in Canton or Boston, right? Ensuring that global wealth flows through their system under their rules.
It really does. And, you know, this raises an important question for you, the listener. We've traced an incredible evolution of methods here today, from forcing physical products like opium into closed markets, to extracting taxes from captive colonies, to fighting covert proxy wars.
And finally, to writing the legal fictions that protect offshore wealth.
Exactly. The legacy of these methods isn't confined to a history textbook. When you look at your own bank accounts, the multinational products you buy, and the global political news you read, that invisible architecture is still operating all around you.
It is. We started today by talking about that comforting traditional map of the British Empire, you know, the visible borders, the red coats, the obvious displays of power.
Yeah, the pink map.
Right. But the sources today force us to look at the world differently. If the traditional measure of a country's power is its military and its physical borders, yet the true control of global wealth sits in tiny, unregulated offshore islands operating on 19th century British legal loopholes.
It's wild to think about.
It leaves us with one final thought to mull over. Where does actual sovereignty reside in the 21st century? Are we all, economically speaking, still living in the British Empire?